The U.S. Senate this week is expected to consider a bill to help address the nation's opioid epidemic. And this past Friday, Senator Ed Markey talked about that bill as he visited a treatment center in Roxbury. Markey blamed the opioid epidemic on pharmaceutical companies and the overprescribing of painkillers like OxyContin.
From a molecular perspective, OxyContin is very similar to heroin. 80% of all of the people who have died from heroin overdoses began on prescription opioid drugs.
The leap from pills to heroin is a common one, but it was not one taken by Dr. Peter Grinspoon. However, when police arrived at his Boston office in 2005 to ask him about falsifying prescriptions for narcotics, he was forced to confront his substance use. He tells the story of his drug use, of treatment, and his return to medicine in the new memoir, Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction. And Dr. Grinspoon is with us in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's start with your opioid use. How did you get to the point where all of a sudden two police officers are in your office because you were filling prescriptions for your former nanny who was actually in New Zealand at the time?
Well, at the time, I was quite addicted to opiates. Mm-hmm. And at the time, and opiates can really affect how you think about things, it seemed like a good idea what I was doing. But yeah. In retrospect, it was like completely crazy. But the addiction kind of sneaks up on you. It started with some experimentation in medical school. And then before you know it, you start to need it every day. And you start to get really sick if you don't take it. So I think it really sneaks up on you.
Hey, explain to me how you justify that to yourself, especially as a doctor, right? You're writing prescriptions. Everyone trusts you. And yet you know that you're definitely doing something you're not supposed to be doing. What are you thinking in that point when you say it seems like a good idea?
Well, at the time, it seemed like a good idea. Mm. In retrospect, it was an awful thing to do. It was reprehensible. Mm. But I view it as addiction sort of takes over parts of your brain. It takes over, eventually, the part of your brain that helps you decide what's right and wrong. It makes you pretty fundamentally selfish because you're focused on your next fix. And it sort of impairs your judgment. So it's fair to say that you're not completely in your right mind when you're completely addicted to opiates because you're desperate to not feel sick.
Now, you said this started in medical school. It went on for several years. How do you think you were able to hide it from so many people, from colleagues and your family and everything else?
Well, I never would do it before seeing patients ever. That was one line I never crossed. Mm-hmm. I would do it mostly at night to kind of escape all my problems. That doesn't mean that I wasn't at my best. That does mean that I wasn't at my best the next day. I was probably shaky, stressed out, withdrawing, nauseous the next day from having taken opiates the night before. But I have a pretty strong work ethic, and doctors are pretty good at hiding these things. Doctors are particularly susceptible to addiction, more than the general population. And I think part of it is that we have a lot of stress, and part of it's that we have a lot of access. But really, with physician addicts, your job is like the last thing to go, because it protects your addiction. It gives you cover, it gives you access, and it gives you the ability to be in denial about your addiction. I mean, I was a doctor. People were really happy with the work I was doing. Like, who would think that I was an addict?
Right. I'm wondering if you could read part of the book where you sort of talk about this double life that you really had to live to try to maintain your habit and maintain your medical practice. And there's a part in the book where you write about this. Can you read this for us?
Absolutely.
Okay.
As I drove back to Boston after my extreme makeover, looking back and trying to make sense of my behavior, there seemed to be a disconnect between the two distinct aspects of Peter Grinspoon that had coexisted in the same body. One Peter was externally perceived to be hardworking, full of idealism, humor, compassion, and a genuine desire to help people. The medical student who was a star, the resident who was a gem, generous and open-minded. My grandmother, the ultimate authority in all things, maintained that I was a mensch. Hmm. Doctors, staff, families, and patients all liked me and appreciated my ability to communicate and to empathize. Operating independently, within the same body, was a Peter who skulked in the shadows and stole pills, who wrote fake prescriptions, formed criminal allegiances with patients, and manipulated his colleagues into prescribing Vicodin for him. This version of Peter was emotionally AWOL from his marriage and lived in an increasingly isolated, surrealistic dream world of pills and deception.
Hmm. That's unbelievable. It's unbelievable you were able to maintain that for a number of years. But you did finally, you start the book with these two police officers coming in and confronting you, and you did go to treatment, but you were forced to go to treatment.
I was absolutely forced. I was very resentful at the pharmacist who busted me. And now in retrospect, I'm like profoundly grateful to her because she saved me. But at the time, again, it's very different at the time. I was really resentful.
So you wouldn't have gone. But if
no,
you would
not
have gone, you would have continued this and been able to rationalize this, and you would have thought, this is okay. I'm doing this because I need to. It's okay. It's a little bit at night. I'm escaping my problems. Whatever things you were telling yourself, you were continuing to tell yourself those things, and had you not been in trouble, you would not have gone.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very controversial how ethical it is to coerce people into treatment, and people have very strong opinions on this. In my case, unless I were club senseless into treatment, I never would have gotten help. My denial was so deeply rooted, and my addiction had taken hold of so many different parts of my personality that I feel that if I weren't absolutely like frog marched into treatment by the medical board and by the criminal justice system, I might have had a very hard time pulling out of this.
Now, you went to various treatment facilities, some that were maybe higher end, if you will, you know, facilities primarily for healthcare professionals who are struggling with drug use. And then you also went to a probation therapist that was required by your probation officer. That was sort of a public, maybe, if you will, right?
Absolutely.
Therapy session. Describe the difference between the two of those, and how common do you think that is? And is there a real difference in treatment for those people with money and those people without?
There's a huge difference in treatment for people with money and people who don't. I mean, I spent 90 days in a rehab facility, and people have criticisms of inpatient rehab facilities, and there's not great evidence that they work better than outpatient, but that's another discussion. But it was really intensively focused on recovery. All the staff who worked there were in recovery, so nobody felt I felt nobody was judging me. And, you know, the resources were incredible. I had group therapy every day. I had medical doctors. I had neuropsychiatric testing. I had frequent checkups. I had support group meetings. It was really amazing treatment. And the treatment that I saw through the court system consisted of just an angry, mean counselor who just berated these angry, pissed off addicts who didn't seem like they cared at all. And it was for an hour a week, they just got yelled at. I mean, in a depressing room in the basement of the courthouse, it couldn't be more different, night and day. And I just have the most profound respect for people who don't have resources, who manage to pull themselves out of addiction, because they're doing it on their own without all the help that I had, for example.
Right. So you are able to overcome a really significant daily opioid problem. And you obviously were forced into doing it because of the dire consequences that might happen if you didn't. But did the system treat you differently because you were a doctor?
Well, I think they did.
Was it better or worse? I mean, some people might look at it worse and say you were in a very trusted position and you did this, right? So was it better?
Right.
Or worse?
Well, doctors who suffer from addiction, and I worked for a couple years for the Physician Health Services, the same group that helped me get over my addiction, helping other doctors who suffer from addiction. And doctors with addiction really seem susceptible to guilt and shame, and they feel like they've let everyone down. And there's a real public stigma to physicians who are addicted, and they sort of get knocked off their pedestal and sort of pilloried in the press. And the medical board makes it very hard for them to get back to work on the one hand. On the other hand, they have a lot to fight for because they want to be doctors again and practice again, and they tend to have more resources to throw at treatment. So I think that in some ways it's a lot easier to be a physician addict, and in some ways it's like vastly more difficult.
What are the numbers about the rate of abuse within the physician community and the rate of recovery?
Well, the rate of abuse in the general population to drugs or alcohol of addiction is estimated to be 9%. Mm-hmm. And among physicians, it's estimated to be 10 to 15%.
Slightly higher.
Well, significantly higher, 10 to 15%. The answer to the question is we don't really know because nobody comes forward and talks about it. The treatment is so punitive. If you're a doctor and you feel like you're having trouble and you go to the medical board, you could have your license taken away, your livelihood stripped from you. And I think that because the response is punitive, a lot of people don't get help, and we don't really know who is addicted and who's having trouble. Doctors are really stressed out these days, and it's just people hide in the shadows, and we don't really hear about a physician who's addicted until the state police come to their office or until the surgeon is drunk in the operating room. So I think if we made the treatment less punitive, we'd find out much earlier and we'd be able to intervene in these cases much earlier, which would save a lot of people a lot of misery and be much safer for the patients. In terms of treatment, ironically, doctors do really well. They have what's estimated to be a 75 to 80% chance of recovery.
Which is hugely different.
Astronomical from the patients that I treat every day in my primary care clinic, in inner city primary care clinic in Boston. Mm-hmm. So the doctors tend to do really well. And I think that at least in the doctors that I've met, both from physician support group meetings and from working with them in physician health services, they tend to be great doctors, like humble, down to earth, living in the moment. They listen really carefully. They seem to really be compassionate. I think that a lot of the tools that you learn in recovery help you not only stay off drugs and alcohol, but help you connect to people better and make you a better doctor.
What was the turning point for you to be able to turn around? You're now practicing medicine again, even though your license was suspended for a while, but you were able to get it all back. But you write in the book about the turning point. And we should say that even though there are higher rates of recovery, you went to treatment and it didn't work immediately. You were still, you know, sneaking around a little bit and you still had those cravings. So what was it that turned it around for you? I think folks who are interested in listening to this want to know, what's a secret to success? What is it?
Well, I think an important secret is to understand that opiate addiction is not a death sentence. And if you read the news these days, you think it is because of all the overdoses. And I think the fact that people stuck with me, friends, family, relatives, colleagues, they stuck with me and they didn't abandon me and they were still there for me. And I think it's so very important that you don't give up on people, no matter how annoying, painful addicts are to deal with. They're still there inside and you just can't give up on them. That was part of it. It was obviously multifactorial. Part of it was the messages of rehab were sinking in. I wasn't 100% successful right away, but the messages were sinking in. And part of it is that I had the physician support group, a lot of drug tests, and I wanted my medical license back.
So you had a lot on the line.
Absolutely. I was going through a divorce. I wanted to see my kids. You know, certainly active addicts who are using don't do very well in divorce cases. And I wanted to be a primary care doctor again with all that I learned in recovery.
Mm-hmm. So what about for those folks who may not have such high stakes on the line? What do you think would turn it around for people? Would it have to, you know, what has to happen inside for someone?
Right. Well, in a sense, everybody has high stakes because you can die and you can overdose. Mm-hmm. But to turn around, it's really difficult. We spent the last couple decades on this war on drugs. And now that all of a sudden we're all sort of surprised by the overdose opiate epidemic, and there's sort of a paucity of treatment resources. And it's really hard to get people into treatment. Even as a primary care doctor, I send patients to treatment and sometimes they get detoxed for 3 days and then they're back on the streets. Mm. And that doesn't help anybody get into recovery. But I think the more we use medication-assisted treatment and there's less of a stigma around that, and the more we can use Suboxone and methadone, and mostly the more we can fight against the stigma so people aren't afraid or embarrassed to get treatment, that will really help.
All right. Dr. Peter Grinspoon, primary care physician on staff at Mass General Hospital. He also teaches medicine at Harvard Medical School. His memoir, Free Refills, is at our website. A link to it is at our website, radioboston.org. Dr. Grinspoon, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.